Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Luis Alberto Urrea, whose latest novel is Queen of America. It's a sequel to The Hummingbird's Daughter. Luis Alberto Urrea is also the author of other novels, including Into the Beautiful North. Nonfiction books include The Devil's Highway. There are 13 books of all, and that includes 3 books of poetry. He is a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois. And this book is the second volume of this 2-volume novelized biography, if you want to call it that, of your great-aunt, Teresa Urrea, and her journey from Mexico to the United States. In the back of Hummingbird's Daughter, you talk a little bit about who she was to you and that you knew that she existed, but it wasn't until sometime in the mid-80s that you found out exactly who she was. How did that happen?
I was born in Tijuana and spent a lot of my childhood in Tijuana or back and forth across the border. I was a classic border rat. You know, the relatives talked about her. There was all kinds of folklore all the time flying around the house. So I heard all this weird stuff about ghosts and devils and demons. And, by the way, you have a Yaqui aunt who's a faith healer and can raise the dead and can levitate and can do all these wild things. And I thought, you know, much of it is just a load of hooey, right? Actually, in 1978, I started working at a Chicano Studies department in a San Diego community college as a bilingual tutor. And the professor there produced a chapter from a Carrie McWilliams book about her. Until that point, I thought she was just, you know, a fantasy. It was in North from Mexico, which was absolutely astonishing to me that she actually existed. Through some bizarre secular miracle or whatever, I got a job teaching writing at Harvard in 1982 at Expos. And I went off there and, you know, puttering around the used bookstores of Boston, found an actual full-length book about her by William Curry Holden. That was around 1985. So at that point, I thought, if only as a kind of a volunteer family historian, I would find everything I could about her so I could report back to my relatives.
And at that particular time, there was no thought, even though you were already a writer, there was no thought of actually doing anything with this.
Well, I didn't think this would happen. You know, I thought at first, oh, this will make a cool article perhaps, you know. And then I thought, well, maybe it'll be my scholarly book. It'll be a footnoted history of her. But the material kept growing and growing and growing. And I realized that as my books began being published and I would do things like go on book tour for the first time, I had opportunities to travel all over the country or in Mexico. And I thought, well, while I'm here, why don't I check out this archive and that archive, you know? Around the early 90s is when I started to realize, wait a minute, this is really going to be something one day. It's actually going to be a book, and I think it's going to be a novel.
Why did you wait then all of those years, because it was published in 2005, or did it take you 10 years to write while you were writing other things?
It took me 20 years of research, because you have to imagine, I had to learn about pre-revolutionary Mexico. I had to learn about the Yaqui and Mayo tribes. I had to find her history, which had been hidden, swept aside and buried by the victors. So I had to dig in archives for a very long time, which is not my forte. And then at a certain point, I had to begin studying with medicine people to understand the shamanic parts of her life I didn't know, and particularly the world of female medicine. And you know, it took a long time, I think, to find the communities that would take me in and reveal their secrets to me.
As you learned this and you realized that you were going to write it, was there any thought of making it nonfiction? Because you're, after all, also known because of Devil's Highway as a nonfiction writer.
Yeah, I have a lot of nonfiction books. I wanted to write a nonfiction piece, but, you know, there comes a moment, I think, when, especially, I think, the crossover into the world of the medicine women, the curanderas and the shamans, when a lot of the work that they do is based on kind of dream time. And I realized that for me, the finest forms of fiction, I think, put readers into a kind of a trance state that can take them to a a kind of a heightened reality that I realized footnotes and history might not do. And so it just started presenting itself as a story. And the more deeply immersed in their daily lives I became, and the more secrets I found out, secrets not by design, just by, you know, the vagaries of history, I started feeling that I myself was entering in the dream world. And it was in some ways writing a very long ballad, you know, a historical novel instead of a history.
Well, as you were working on Hummingbird's Daughter, which takes us the first part of her life, which is as the Joan of Arc of Mexico.
Yeah, that's what they said.
Well, she was both a revolutionary and a shaman at the same time. And then the second part, Queen of America, the new book, is about her life in America after she left Mexico. But as you were doing this, Hummingbird's Daughter, were you getting all kinds of flights of dreams yourself?
Yeah, man. Yeah, you don't go to their world and not come out unscathed. Yeah, and I would have these just crazy experiences, you know, and I had to learn rather quickly, partially as a self-preservation thing, I think, that when you're talking to a medicine person and they tell you something and you think, wow, that's really symbolic and really poetic and metaphoric, and they meant it absolutely dead on, literally, boom, this weird thing I just said to you is reality. That was fascinating. One of the things, for example, I was given dreams. They can make you dream. And one of the shaman guys, he was actually a Chiricahua Apache medicine man, when he told me, I'm going to give you a ritual, and you're going to do this ritual for 3 days and three nights, and then you're going to have a dream, and you're going to contact me and tell me what it was in the dream, and we will work out what the message was. And he said, listen, because they were very sophisticated, which I thought was amazing. And he said, I don't care if my medicine works or not, or if this little ritual I'm giving you is programming that little computer you've got in your subconscious, doesn't matter to me. What's interesting is the result. And he was right. I did the thing, and I had this unbelievable visionary dream, which was stunning, because they kept telling me in the medicine world, when you have a dream that is not a dream, you've gone somewhere else. And you can tell because it's different than what you've ever dreamed before. It feels different. You're moved. You wake up laughing or crying and so forth. And the first dream that he gave me was Teresita actually coming to my house. And she brought me six white flowers and gave me her blessing. That kind of freaked me out.
From the perspective of Luis Alberto Urrea, Hummingbird's Daughter is not magic realism.
It's the reverse. The story I like to tell out on the road is that, you know, it was intended as this historical novel. And in my master plan, these are really the two halves of the same book. But it was so frickin' giant that I thought readers are going to die of boredom or exhaustion if they try to read it all at once. But as we were editing it, my editor started slashing out some of this marvelous stuff. And I said, what are you doing? He said, what's a historical novel? I'm taking out some of the weird stuff and hewing to the history. And I said, here's what's funny. All that stuff is the actual recorded history, and the historical data that we're saving is what I invented, because I have no idea what they ate. I don't know what kind of clothes they wore. The ranch is actually gone. I've recreated it in imagination. You know, part of the ranch is based on a place I found in the south of France. I said, that's all fantasy. The stuff you think is magical is the stuff that is eyewitness accounts, even from the New York Times, watching her do these things. And so it became kind of the reverse of magical realism. And the reviews have all been, you know, mad for this imagined link to Garcia Marquez. And I always tell people, I think it's because many reviewers, that's the Latin American they've read. You know, I don't know if they have a deep well of people to compare it to, but I was hoping for a little bit of Juan Rulfo maybe in Latin America. And I was totally ripping off Malcolm Lowry. Not enough people are reading Under the Volcano anymore.
Luis Alberto Urrea, that puts like someone like Carlos Castaneda in a completely different light, what you're saying.
Ooh, Carlos Castaneda, he's a sore point with the Yaqui people. They don't like him.
Why?
Because they say he lied. Everything in Don Juan is fake and false. All the details about Yaqui religion, psychoactive substances and so forth. And it was really weird because in 95 I went to Arizona to be near the Yaqui people. I thought, wait a minute, I'm writing this epic about their history and I don't really know them very well. And I stumbled into family. I didn't know I had cousins and so forth. And as I got to know people in the community, they were very against the Castaneda books, partially because those books inspired every hippie on the planet to descend on them and seek wisdom. And I found myself in a controversy that I didn't even know existed. But what was interesting is one of my contacts, an indigenous healer, said, here's the secret about Don Juan. He said, that stuff is true, but it's not about Yaquis. He said, Don Juan, and this is just a guy in the field, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt. They said Don Juan was Navajo. And he said that Castaneda had tried to hide the identity in a way so that they weren't harassed. And he picked, you know, the most obscure tribe he could think of, the Yaquis. Not in any way knowing this was going to be the most popular book in the world for a season. And that he was really trying to pursue this path. And that he really did have some shamanic powers that people had observed. And I heard crazy stories about him by people who were associates of his. So that fascinated me.
In terms of both Hummingbird's Daughter and Queen of America, when you're going into these altered state, these dreams, okay, yeah. You know, part of the writing itself is about altered states. It's about channeling material that you don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So did these dreams, did these sessions you did with the Yaquis, how did they impact the actual writing of both books? And Hummingbird's Daughter is a little bit different from Queen of America, because Queen of America is much more straightforward historical novel.
Yeah.
I mean, as we know the historical novel to
be. It's ragtime with miracles, if you think about it.
But in terms of what you were doing, how did those dreams affect the writing of both books?
Oh, absolutely permeated them. For example, the first book I wrote as a kind of a book full of wonders that also served as a bit of a template if you wanted to understand the initiation process into the sacred work. The second book has a different focus, but it still, I think, maintains those same dreamlike elements. I mean, there are healings all through it. You know, it's about sacredness and the grip on sacredness. For example, the dreams in Hummingbird's Daughter that carry over into Queen of America are the actual dreams, the shamanic dreams in order that the medicine people gave me. You know, I could put that framework on the skeleton of history and then carry these characters through time. That's one way. The first book, if you think about it, she herself was the sort of wonder generator. She was the source of all this tumult and hubbub. At the time, the revolution was heating up. Indigenous warfare was heating up. And as one of the Lister in Chihuahua Storehouse of Storms said, those hills bred messiahs like mushrooms after a rainstorm. So there were all these messianic movements that were happening around the same time as the ghost dance up here. And so, you know, if you look at the waves of war and massacre, the big massacre, there's a huge massacre that happened of her followers that happened at the same time as Wounded Knee here. And I don't think it's accidental. In the second book, warriors went to battle wearing her picture, thinking it would stop bullets, which was very much like the ghost shirts of the ghost dancers. One of the themes that I realized through these tribal people was the sort of continental flow of information, mythology, trade that we don't think about, that there was no, of course, Mexican border to them. And there still is not. If you go down there, there are nations that exist in both alleged countries, and they think their land is the country, not ours. So we laid a fence across the heart of their continent. That's fascinating to me, and that's all in the book. And then she gets here, and it becomes a kind of a science fiction story. I always think of Arthur C. Clarke. It's like a 2001, where this woman who had this whole lifeway comes here, and this place is the accelerated magic, and it overwhelms her. They're eating ice cream. They're playing this baseball. You know, there are trains everywhere. She sees automobiles. There's all this tumult happening in the press. And, you know, it becomes a story of trying to hold on to that nugget of wonder with all this madness swirling around you as America wakes up and takes off into a new century.
You're listening to an interview with Luis Alberto Urrea, whose latest novel is Queen of America. when you're writing, I mean, the technical aspect of writing, you're trying to create, as you've said in an interview, a sense of daily sacredness
yeah.
in terms of Teresita. But when you're writing, you're also writing about a human being, which means that you're trying to combine sainthood and a human being at the same time. And from a technical standpoint, how easy or difficult
That's tough, man. That's really tough, man. But, you know, it's interesting to me because she never sought any kind of sainthood. And she fought it her whole life till her dying breath. I'm not a saint. I'm a woman.
From the written record.
From her actual record, yeah. And some of the people turned against her, which I thought was deeply ironic, as soon as they realized she was human. She had children, you know, she had a man in her life, and they thought, well, you're no virgin. It pointed out a lot of the absurdity that happens with religious manias that kick off. I think, you know, as a writer, the struggle for me was that in the first book, dealing with her training and her kind of coming of age in this tradition, where she wanted to be a midwife and an herbalist. And then things came upon her she didn't ask for and changed her. And she wrestled with this sacredness. But some of the critics, the reviews were great. And I should have sent them all $5 and thanks, you know, because they were really kind. But a whole bunch of them said, well, this is kind of Catholic Lives of the Saints hagiography, you know. So in this book, I tried to deal with what happens with that burden that you're carrying, that you come into this other world and you're trying to do these other things while maintaining a little of it. And some of the critics have wondered, well, where did all the hagiography go? Because now it's modern. But I thought, that's true. It is modern. And you almost, I think, have to add so many things to your backpack, and it becomes one of them instead of the only thing.
There's also another element, which is that in the first book, it's all magical what she's doing. In the second book, she's being exploited.
You know, people forget, I think, also how young she was. You know, I think we think of her as the Joan of Arc, the Queen of the Yaquis, the Saint of Cabora. But she came to the United States a fairly sheltered teenager in her mid-teens. And she had a rupture with her family at about the age of 18, 19, 20.
That rupture is described in Queen of America, where she leaves her father. How much of that is based on actual history?
Yeah, it's the true history. Everything in both books is the actual timeline of the events in their lives. That really happened. And thereafter, she was confronting America on her own. So she fell into the clutches of a medical consortium who had heard that Teresita had made a vow to God that she would not profit from this gift. And so, being sly capitalists, they showed up with a contract and said, you sign this, we promise you won't make any profit. And she signed.
Now, the story of the Van Orders,
yeah,
that's real,
yeah,
too.
Absolutely.
John Van Order was her husband, and he was kind of a cowboy.
He was a very interesting, kind of dangerous guy, I think, on some level. Dark, mysterious. He's a mystery to the family. Her great-granddaughters were very present with me working on this. I mean, not spiritually, actually, physically over
cups of
coffee, you know?
Yeah.
Because when you're talking about this book, you don't know if you're talking about a wraith or a person. But this was the real people. And they are baffled by him, who he was. You know, I got everything I could possibly find about him and tried to construct a believable character and sort of deal with some of the foibles. He was a guy who really did not like the cowboy life. He really didn't like the frontier and the suffering. He wanted to be a city man. He wanted to be a sophisticate. And in that way, I think he had a real effect on her, because his dream was to go to New York City and be a gentleman, find some way to force his way into being a gentleman. You know, he prevailed on her. That's how she got to New York, really, through John Van Order and the consortium and this shady character that I couldn't really get enough material on.
That Suits?
Oh, Suits. Another real guy. You know, weird. I met a Suits scholar on this book tour. I thought, wait a minute, there's a Suits scholar? Are you kidding? John Suits has a scholar? And she says to me, you know, he was kind of a slippery character. I said, no kidding, the guy was a sleazeball.
But so you're talking about Rosecrans, right?
Rosecrans.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a very fascinating guy, and there's a lot of confused family lore about him. So I hewed to the historical record about him. You know, I'll wait on, because I just don't know about the folklore about his involvement, because there are different versions of who he was in their lives, if anyone. One of the things we're doing on my website is we're constructing a Teresita sub-site, putting up my bibliography at last so people can research, because there's some PhDs going on now about her. But the really exciting thing is the actual descendants we've invited to write their own memoirs, and we're posting them so you can read, you know, the family stories directly from the family, which will be really fun.
Well, I'd never heard of her, and I guess you would not even either, which meant that
she was lost.
That the entire history, an entire element of Mexican history, according to Hummingbird's daughter and Queen of America, I mean, a major portion of it, you had a rebellion that was put down and no mention of it, and no mention of this icon who became the symbol of the rebellion.
Yeah. It's a very interesting thing if you think about it. Indigenous, so it got discounted a bit. Woman got discounted furthermore. She died in 1906, and then right after she died, the actual revolution ignited. And these were massive, convulsive events. So just by the very nature of the hugeness, I think, of the revolution itself, her story was pushed aside, along with many. I mean, if you start digging into 1905, 1906 Mexico, you'll find these fabulous and troubling stories. And if you look into the Mexican history right after the revolution, there was all this crazy Cormac McCarthy-style violence and darkness also. But it was the revolution itself that pushed her aside. So, you know, when I started looking into her, I was amazed, if not actually shocked, that she had so much attention. And my wife, investigative journalist, so it was really helpful to have her helping me find data and to find her in the L.A. Times and New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle. She was in the Fort Wayne, Indiana paper. She was in papers in Alaska. People wrote about her not only in Mexico but all over the United States. And it just sort of filtered into dusty archives because there was nobody that rescued it. And this fellow, William Curry Holden, was kind of an anthropologist, sociologist who was an expert in the Yaquis, had never heard of her until he was doing field work in the late 50s and people started mentioning her. So he did this book. And then Brianda Domecq from the Domecq Liquor family, she wrote a book about her as well. So there have been people who rediscover her over the ages. Chicanos often gravitate toward her, that she was like the first Chicana heroine, you know.
Well, when you're writing this book and you're dealing with all of this information, and you said in an interview that after the first book came out, suddenly people were coming out of the woodwork with material.
Yeah.
I mean, I could understand in Hummingbird's Daughter, because the nature of the story may be real, but it feels fictional. You've got Joan of Arc in a war in Mexico.
Yeah.
Queen of America is different. I mean, this book could have been 2,000 pages long. How did you choose what to put in, what to take out?
Oh, I left so much out. Some of the stuff was so fabulous and so rich. For example, at the beginning of the novel, you hear about her having a Quadimundi for a pet. That's in no history book anywhere except that a rancher family from that Tubac area, they wrote to me and they said, you know what's cute about her is that whenever we see Quadimundis walking around, they say, oh, Teresita's here because she had a pet. And they told me this whole story about how everywhere she went in Tubac, she was accompanied by this creature. That was so rich, you know, I had to put it in. That was like oral history that went into the novel. The reason it wasn't 2,000 pages long is I was very conscious of the fact that she's in the U.S. now and things are moving at a faster and faster clip. You know, she's in the Millennium Falcon hitting hyperspace for her. And that's why there's that whole passage about Segundo doesn't want to ride a train because he knows that gravity won't let him go and he'll be slammed to the back wall and killed. That was something my grandfather apparently told everybody back in the cowboy days.
Now, Segundo himself, is that a real person?
No.
How about the story of the assassins who come to take her out?
They came. There's no evidence of who they were or even many of the events, but they came in Arizona and they came in El Paso. So the visions of these sort of demonic figures rushing up out of Mexico to take her out, you know, it's my fictionalization of that little nugget of information.
But they stopped. I mean, at some point they stopped. Was it because she was suddenly just a healer in St. Louis and, you know, nobody cared anymore?
For people with certain political paranoia, now that we're in the age of conspiracies. When they first came here, the government kept her within fewer than 100 miles from the Mexican border, and her father could not get that embargo broken. And there's a whole body of thought that it was a collusion between the U.S. and Mexico that Díaz was going to have to take her out. But when, through the efforts of Lauro Aguirre and her father and people, that sanction was lifted and she could go far away from the border, it just, I think, became tactically impossible for them to pursue her. And I think she became so visible. She's in the magazines, she's in Overland Monthly, you know, she's being interviewed, she's in the New York Times, so on and so forth. It just became untenable. And at the same time, I think that the Yaqui revolts sort of took up a weird life of their own. And the thing I didn't pursue in this novel, just because I thought it might slow down the momentum a bit, was that Mexico shifted its attempts to get her from actual hands-on assassination, which I think ended with Lupe Rodriguez up in Clifton, really. I think he was an assassin.
That's the first husband. You kind of indicate that he might have been.
Nobody knows. That's one of the things that's such a bramble patch, is nobody knows for certain many of the things. And so one weighs all the theories and looks at them all and tries to deal with them. But anyway, Mexico started going after her in Washington, lobbying, going to Congress and saying, this girl's terrible and she's going to get your tribe stirred up again. So, you know, in some sense, Mexico was forced into the modern world and stop trying to assassinate people and maybe try to do political skullduggery instead to get her back, because they wanted to stop her and silence her. But yeah, this business, for example, of Guadalupe Rodriguez, no one knows what happened there. Nobody understands what really happened in that moment when he went mad. And I don't want to give away too much, but he was bad. And there is a very strong sense that he was some kind of an assassin actually sent to her, because his form of access to get to her was her language. She had been cast out and would never see her people again and would never hear her mother tongue again. And he appeared out of nowhere speaking Cajita, the Yaqui language. And that's how he weaseled his way into her life and gained her trust.
And it's you as a novelist, and I guess this is the real challenge, of trying to figure out why someone like Teresita would wind up with Lupe and why she would wind up later with kind of, you know, this semi-cowboyish guy. I'm trying to figure that out.
They make sense to me on a couple of levels. You know, anybody who's had a teenage daughter, I don't think dads approve of the boyfriend no matter what, right? But, you know, Lupe showed up and he did all the right things. He spoke the mother tongue. He gave evidence of believing as she did. He knew about the sacredness in that old tradition. And he turned her head with his love and his desire. She'd not been loved. She'd not even been loved by parents. She'd never had real romance or love. And I think he turned her head, and at that moment she made the impulsive decision to go with him instead of her family, and it went horribly wrong. And I don't think Van Order was ever her intent as a lover. She had partially grown up with him. She'd known him as a boy. She was out in the world in St. Louis. She asked the family to send the son to help translate, and they sent the wrong son. There was a sweeter boy that she felt close to. She wasn't that crazy about Van Order. Now, interestingly enough, one of the conspiracy theories is that Mr. Rosecrans paid Van Order to go out and bodyguard her, that he wanted her protected. But I can't find historical evidence of that, nor family evidence of that, just, you know, one cousin saying, I know because great-grandma said that blah, blah, blah. But I didn't go there.
Well, if you're getting paranoid, you could also say that Rosecrans, by removing her from the world of being an actual bruja and putting her into the world of American spiritualism and healing in, you know, 1900, on some level, is removing her from the political scene.
I just got dinged by a review that basically said, why wasn't she more political and why wasn't she leading the Indians in revolt? And I want to say, well, you know, this is a problem of a historical novel. You're stuck with the history.
Right.
It's not like I made up a faulty political plot. This is what happened in her life. I think she got so distracted that, you know, the end of the book was intended, you know, to her sort of fighting back to get her spirit and vision. It's just her body was failing her. But, yeah, Rosecrans is a real guy. She really did come to San Jose to heal his son. I mean, I changed that around a little bit and had her heal the boy in Clifton. But she actually came here, and she healed another person's child here in the San Francisco area and moved in with them for a bit.
Why did you do that? Why did you make that change? Why did you move it from San Jose to Clifton?
I think it was Mark Twain who said, you know, novels have to make sense, real life doesn't, right? And the avalanche of events was so odd that sometimes events would bunch up. And I thought, you know, so she's going to come to San Jose and she's going to heal a powerful man's son and then turn around and heal a powerful woman's daughter. It messed up, I felt, the kind of balance of the fictional flow of the text. It gave those two elements, I think, much too much gravity at that point in the story. The other part being that when I first started working on this, I went up to Clifton, Arizona in 1988 and hung out for a week with a lot of the people in the town historian. And the first versions I'd heard, she'd actually done that in Arizona. And sometimes, you know, those stories that you first hear kind of become embedded in the fictional matrix that you're working on. So that's kind of stuff that happens in a movie where they say, wait a minute, that didn't happen then, that happened here. But
so in essence, what happened was most likely Rosecrans came to Clifton and said, I will pay you a way to go to San Jose.
Yeah, he was in Clifton. There were a lot of businessmen in the Morenci area because of Phelps Dodge Mining. It was a big capitalist, like, you know, the guys call him Plutes. And Tomas kind of liked the Plutes because he wanted to be a rich man again. And Rosecrans, after the family crisis, orchestrated bringing Teresita out here to the San Francisco area. And she went down to San Jose and stayed in San Jose for a while and had that whole tumultuous period when the consortium finally took her over. And they did install her in that house at that address, you know, pre-earthquake. And she really was rescued by a couple of detectives. I was having some fun, and I made one of them Gavin Newsom just for the hell of it. But, you know, it was one of her followers did go to the police and complain that they were keeping her against her will. And that's unclear in that we don't have testimony from Teresita. The evidence is that the consortium kept her locked up in this house, healing people all day long, and they controlled everything she did. And she was under contract to them, so she worked out the contract till she was free, which is what Van Order was partly about, to help her bust out of this white man's deal.
Luis Alberto Urrea, before we go on to a couple of other questions, in these visions, these dreams you had, as you're working on the book and dealing with the historical record, was there any place where they differed? And if they did, which way did you go?
Wow. I think sometimes what I had imagined, because as a novelist, you know, you play, right? You play with stuff, yeah. And you try to – you make a mental film in a way. Those things changed, and effects changed, and little things like, you know, people in various medicine traditions not wanting readers to know the rituals that I was putting in the book. And they told me things like, you know, those people don't need this word. We need this word. It's none of their business. Those little ways – course adjustments. That was really useful. Those things, I think, affected it. And mostly, I think they added richness. If there's richness in either book, it's probably from those senses. I have to say also, though, when you're dealing with curanderas, for example, and they'll tell you, well, the spirits have moved into your house and they're helping you write it. And there's stuff Teresita didn't like in her life and doesn't want anybody to know about. Don't worry about it because they will erase that from your mind. You'll forget to type it. So it was this really bizarre, you know, writing as ritual for both books that I had not known before. But I ended up having a lot of trust in that. I thought, okay, I'm in a process older than myself, and I'm going to trust that process.
Between the two books you wrote, Into the Beautiful North, you were still involved in doing this dream work. Did you do that at all for that novel?
No, man. Beautiful North came from a specific thing, and that was – you know, I've worked on border issues my whole life. I'm a border rat. I was born on the border. And I had done 3 nonfiction books about the border and then Devil's Highway, where I had to go penetrate the Border Patrol and all this stuff. Really unlikely, by the way, me with the Border Patrol. But there I was. That book did incredibly well and set this new agenda for me in a way. But it was hellish. It was a hellish thing dealing with all that death and nightmare. And dealing with the Teresita story, was very difficult and even painful in a lot of ways. So, you know, there came this moment when I thought, I'm going to write a book that makes me laugh every day. I'm just going to write a book that makes me happy. But I'm not going to abandon my interest in a literature of witness. And I thought it would be really subversive if I wrote a book intended as a kind of a pop book, a beach book, which Latina Magazine, thank God, picked as one of their top beach books, in which people in the United States, especially at the height of Tea Party mania, started rooting for undocumented Mexicans to evade the Border Patrol and succeed. And I thought it would also be subversive if I made the male hero a young gay man looking for a man to love, and the secondary male a cholo garbage picker from the Tijuana, all people that we would disparage and make them the heroes. I thought that was cool. And the last kind of connection to all this, I think, is that it was of a piece with Hummingbird's Daughter, in that the young women in this book, Into the Beautiful North, are the people she would have been attending to. It's sort of the Teresita world without Teresita. These were the people she would have been helping and healing.
And while you were busy writing that, you were still doing research for Queen of America.
Oh, yeah, always. Oh, yeah, always. I mean, you know, I don't want people to think I sat in a sad garret with an oil lamp for 26 years scratching away with a quill pen. You know, you live and you get married and have kids and have a job and write other books and write mystery stories and do all that other stuff, but you're always accumulating information.
Luis Alberto Urrea, I was looking through getting online earlier today and came on a link in an interview. You made the following comment, which struck me as very interesting because it's something we don't normally think about. And it kind of is a different frame for looking at the border. What you said was, illegal immigration is a 20th century problem. They've stopped coming in. The real problem is the insurgent narco-terrorist war that's starting now, and they're annihilating journalists.
They are. They're annihilating social network people now, too. They're hunting them down. I started trying to tell people over 10 years ago that this was coming. So now I'm just tired of it. I'm tired of the bogus immigration crap flying around. And, you know, people are promoting this alleged invasion that's going on. And I just tell them, that's so 20th century, man. You know, and we don't have a secure militarized border. And I think, well, first, go to that border and find out if it's militarized or not. Try driving down Texas 90 from San Antonio to Marfa and see if that ain't militarized, brother. You know, the Border Patrol station in Welton that I did the book with, they had 32 agents back in the day. And now they have over 300 agents. They had to tear down the station and build a huge station to hold the agents because the walkers they weren't passing through. So the numbers are precipitously down. Possibly 300,000 people or more this year have gone back to Mexico. But it was very clear even back then that the criminal elements were slowly overtaking the ground game along the border. Even during right at the Devil's Highway, when I was going down and hanging out in Sasabe, the big smuggling town. Sasabe was on one side cheek to jowl with a huge narco-cocaine operation. And when I would go down there, the narco gunmen would show up in their vehicles, and they would watch us from a distance as we looked at the immigrants. And, you know, the beta cops, the Mexican beta police, who were the Mexican immigration police, they were very clear about what was happening. They weren't allowed weapons by the Mexican government. They were sent out in the desert with fluorescent orange vests so the bad guys can see you 20 miles away. You know, at nighttime, they would go inside their police station and lock all the doors and barricade them and wouldn't come out till sunlight. And the narcos would bring victims and execute them on the steps and leave the bodies. These guys wouldn't open the doors. So it was clear that these underworld elements were becoming the major players. And I said in Devil's Highway, soon someone is going to begin sort of becoming the godfather and taking control of everything. And that's what I think some of these, Chapo Guzman and some of those guys, I think found ways to consolidate a lot of disparate elements of the crime organization. But the numbers of crossers are very far down. The numbers of deaths haven't dropped because it's such a harsh journey. So I think if you look at charts, because the numbers have stayed steady, if not upticked a little bit in deaths, it makes an even worse percentage-wise kind of a death situation.
And in the context of the politics of the day, what do you think is actually going on? The Mexican government and the U.S. government, what role are they playing in allowing this narco-terrorism to happen on the border?
It's baffling, isn't it? I mean, you know, just these last few days I've been following these stories. We found out about the Fast and the Furious gun trading that the government did with the narcos. And you say, what the hell is that all about? Now they're starting to admit, well, yes, we've been laundering money, millions upon millions of dollars for narco people. Even the DEA is now being facing allegations of that. There's a piece this morning saying, well, the United States actually has been providing some safe haven for powerful narcos in the U.S. And you think, what in the world is going on? I don't know. Calderon, the president of Mexico, is a really controversial figure at this point because some people accuse him of being embroiled with them. Some people see him as the savior and the strong man. I heard him say something that I thought was really amusing. He said, this is what it's like to be Mexico. He said, imagine that I have an apartment next to the apartment of the greatest drug consumer and weapon exporter on the planet. And he said, people keep coming to my window to pass drugs to that guy's apartment. He said, that's what it's like being the neighbor. And I thought that was, you know, that's an interesting take. I have no idea what is going on. I know that, you know, at the highest levels of the Mexican government, it's opaque. I know a lot of people on the consular corps, for example, or on the law enforcement front, and in spite of what people think in this country, they are just amazing. They're brilliant. They're dedicated. They're forward-thinking, progressive, brave. They have to be brave. But on the ultimate street level with a cop who might make $20 a week as a police officer and has to provide his own weapon and ammo, and someone comes in and says, I'll pay you $3,000 a week. So very confusing.
I'm not someone who buys into conspiracy theories, but, you know, when you see the militarization of the border, you see a pumped-up narco-terrorism. I was in New York, and this is the first time I've ever seen it. That may have been there, but not that presence. U.S. Army troops in Penn Station, and I'm going, what the hell is happening to this country? And then you hear about what happened with Occupy Oakland.
I know. It was insanity. I don't know. One of the senior supervisory agents, the Border Patrol, down in the Texas El Paso area, a really decent guy who thinks I'm brain damaged because I'm a liberal, you know, but he forgives me because I wrote a book he likes and he's kind to me. But, you know, it's with a pained patience that he has dealt with me. And I saw him a year ago and I asked him, so what is the biggest challenge right now to the Border Patrol agent? And he said, boredom. I said, boredom? He said, why do you think they're reading your books, man? He said, we used to get 75 to 100 people a night. We're lucky if we get 75 a month in this heavily traveled sector. And I said, so what does that mean for the Border Patrol? He said, they have more agents than ever in history. His station, like Welton Station, was traditionally 30-agent station, and it's over 300 also. And he said, there is movement afoot to begin internal border patrol. Washington wants to send several thousand of these extra guys now to your neighborhood, drive around. And he said, and I thought this was really interesting, he said, we in the field are very much against it. We don't want that. For all the reasons that you and I would say, he's like, what are they going to do, stop Italians? You know? And I said, this is kind of ironic because I'm Irish looking and I could be in a group of Italian pals and they let me go because all I have to do is say, you know, go Raiders, man, you know, go Dolphins. And I look like a Bubba. But I'm the only guy born in Tijuana in that group. So the agents in the field are aware of how impossible that is. And I think they don't like the thought of internal border patrols getting creepy.
Luis Alberto Urrea, now you've finished Queen of America. I guess you're pretty much done for the moment with Teresita.
Yes.
Have you started working on another novel?
Yeah, man. I told the people last night in Corte Madera, I said, you know, it's like graduating from the longest high school in history, man. And I got the mortarboard on right now. Yeah, I'm free. And I'm just exulting in the opportunity to go in any direction I want. I think I've complied with my life's work, and I can follow other paths. I've been having fun writing mystery stories and noir stories. I actually accidentally won an Edgar Award last year. I didn't mean to, but I thought, wow, you know, I just kind of wrote it and wanted to go see some of my hero writers, and then I got an award, so that was pretty sweet. I'm working on a World War II novel right now. You know, I think my readers will be shocked because they'll be looking for the Mexicans. But this is about people from Matatuck, Long Island.
And National City Reparation Society. That's an online novel. Short story.
Yeah. Short story, yeah. Yeah, about these idiots. You like to have fun with this stuff. And one of my pals in the border writing world is Charles Bowden. So in the National City Reparation Society, one of the guys sees a Chuck Bowden article about all the abandoned houses on the I-15 corridor. So they make up a phony federal bank, the Bowden Federal Bank, and they take a truck up there and go to the houses and steal all the TVs and stuff.
Final question. Hummingbird's Daughter, on your website you said it was optioned by Luis
Mandoki
for Antonio Banderas. Has there been any movement on that?
Only a movement into nothing. It moved into oblivion, man. I have no idea. They were supposed to start filming in April, and then just they were gone. So I don't know. Anything's possible, right? My agent always tells me when we're dealing with Hollywood, not only wait until the check comes, but wait till it clears before you make any plans. So they may come back. I have no idea.
And Queen of America, I guess, nothing yet.
Nothing yet, but since the Hummingbird looks like it's free, who knows what will come of that, if anything.
With the world of long-form television now.
What I would love to see. I think it would be so cool to be a little, you know, minor Game of Thrones kind of a story and be able to do the whole arc because, you know, splitting it into two books, it actually has kind of a reverse structure from the first book in the second book in that the first book starts with this mystical, cosmic, small story that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and then begins in the middle of bigness and moves back down to the mystical and small personal story of Teresita and God, which I think is ultimately what the story was always about, her attempt to be related to God in her own way. Now, some family members say she was just stone cold crazy, you know. So I've tried to take a bit of that into consideration, too, that maybe she was just mad. Could be.
You've been listening to an interview with Luis Alberto Urrea, whose latest novel is Queen of America. It's a sequel to Hummingbird's Daughter. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.